Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The food scene of New Orleans has changed enormously in the 10 years since Hurricane Katrina. The city has been inundated with ambitious young entrepreneurs who are making a mark on the culinary landscape in a big way. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we'll tour the Bywater and visit some of the new exciting eateries proliferating that area. Then, we'll go to Gentilly to investigate the edible education revolution that is the edible schoolyard. The program, begun by Alice Waters in Berkeley, California, has grown beyond her wildest dreams in New Orleans charter schools, growth that is unparalleled in Berkeley or anywhere else in the country. And Leah Chase joins us to share her priceless wisdom about lessons we should all learn from the city's recovery. We've come a long way since 2005, and we're taking you along for the exhilarating ride on this week's Louisiana Eats. Possibly, the most positive voice in New Orleans is that of 92-year-old Leah Chase. Leah has seen it all in her lifetime, including something she'd never expected to see or have to live through, Hurricane Katrina. She and I really don't like to relive any of that, and instead prefer to look at the many gifts that came from the horrific experience.
We don't look for the bad in everything. Look for the good. And believe me, there are more good things than bad things. And you know, Poppy, I feel this way. I'm a believer in God, you know that. And when things happen like Katrina, it's for a purpose. You know, we sit up in New Orleans, we think we haven't made a change, taking everything for granted. And to me, God said, I'm going to slap you down, now you pick it up again. I'm going to slap you down, now you pick it up again. And that we have done. We had this old project across the street with the ugly stack of bricks. Take that out. It served a purpose. That purpose is over. Now you start again. Put new housing, better housing for people. And we did that. Go back in City Park. To me, that was the most hurting thing after the storm, when I saw those trees gone.
Yes.
You can replace a house. I can build a house in a month. How long it takes you to grow a tree? But we're beginning to come back with our trees, and then we appreciate them a little bit more. Those oaks who withstood the storm, we learn to sit in them and appreciate them. And all those things are important, and that's the good side of things. Don't keep gloating on the same old, same old. And everything that you think is bad, look for the good in it. It's just like looking at art. You might say, this is the ugliest thing I've ever seen. Take another look. Take another look.
Leah Chase of Dookie Chase Restaurant. When people talk about growth after the storm, few top the growth story of the edible schoolyard, New Orleans. Over the last 10 years, what began as a project at a single school, Samuel J. Green Elementary, the edible schoolyard program has blossomed into 5 schools across the city of New Orleans, serving students from pre-K through high school.
My name is Claudia Barker, and I'm the executive director of Edible Schoolyard New Orleans. Today, we are at Arthur Ashe Charter School, which is located in the Oak Park neighborhood out near City Park. near the intersection of Fillmore and Paris Avenue, where we have a wonderful school. We're going into our fourth year in this building. We host about 70 different special events a year, including open garden days that everybody's welcome to come in and help garden. We teach a little bit about garden. We feed people lunch. So we get families, we get students, we get neighbors who are interested in learning and helping. And we do things like take the entire third grade to the farmer's market for market to table. We partner our third graders with volunteer chefs. We give them a little budget and they decide what they're going to cook from the seasonal produce and what's offered at the farmer's market. They come back to school, they cook, and they then share the meal with their families. We do Iron Chef competitions with our fifth graders and our seventh graders. Again, our friends from the chef community. We have wonderful, wonderful friends who keep coming back and helping divide the whole class, 100 and some odd children, up into six teams. They're given a secret ingredient at the very last minute, and it's usually something local and seasonal, like Creole cream cheese or sweet potatoes or, you know, whatever's in season at the moment. And then they all compete to see who's going to win the coveted prize, you know, for the best dish. And the magical thing about edible schoolyards is that it's not just about growing food, it's about how to cook it, and specifically how to cook it in healthy ways. And then even more important than all that is how to enjoy it in community. Because in our day and age, people don't sit down and have dinner together very often anymore in busy families. So it's really about teaching children the joys of conversation, about being able to share food together as a group, and to deepen their relationships over beautiful food.
Well, if no one has had the opportunity to visit the incredibly gorgeous Arthur Ashe campus, can we take them virtually there for a visit?
Oh, definitely. Yes, let's go.
Let's do that. Claudia, I have to tell you that anybody who loves to cook or loves to be in a kitchen would envy this kitchen experience. Tell me everything you've got here and how it works.
We have three islands, and so we can accommodate up to 30 students, and we break them into three groups, and we have one educator per group, and that's mostly for safety, and also so that the students can get a small group learning experience. And in the beginning, with kindergartners, it's food ABCs, so they literally eat the alphabet, which means that they try a whole lot of new things that they've never maybe tried before. And then by the time they are in fifth and sixth grade, they're actually developing serious knife skills, so they can really chop vegetables and cook and plan a meal. And by the time they're graduated from here, these are kids who can get dinner on the table. So if you want, we can take a walk through the gym, and I can show you what will be ultimately a one-acre garden. So this is the site of the future edible schoolyard garden. And that little tiny plot that is planted right there will yield about 350 pounds of sweet potatoes, believe it or not. And we will have our sweet potato fest here in the neighborhood in early November. And we will have the crudataters, where we walk around the neighborhood celebrating the wonderful tuber. And giving away sweet potatoes with glitter on them, kind of like the Zulu coconut idea, with dancing girls and marching bands and the whole bit, and hundreds of people come out for that. But for now, we've just sort of outlined the space with these holly trees. We have our compost area over there at the end, and a little bit in between the compost area and where the sweet potatoes are planted will be the site of our Emeril Lagasse Foundation greenhouse, which is going to be the place where we propagate plants for the whole network, all five schools in that greenhouse. Then there'll be this wonderful walkway with small gathering spaces, kind of beautifully architecturally designed, so that people can bring out small group classes. And then at this end will be the Ruth U. Fertel outdoor classroom, which will be both a space for garden class, but also teaching demo space for culinary as well. So we'll be able to do cookouts, and we'll be able to do culinary lessons outside, harvesting stuff right from the garden and cooking it, and taking our program back to the earth.
Such inspirational work. So thank you so much for taking us on this special tour.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And thanks for coming out.
Keep up the good work, Claudia.
Oh, thank you, Poppy. So happy to have you on the task force.
Thank you. Claudia Barker, Executive Director of the Edible Schoolyard New Orleans.
Man made the buildings that reach for the sky. And man made the boat's car and learned how to drive. But he didn't make the flowers and he didn't make the trees.
To give you an idea how edible education really works, we have to call in an old friend, the little red hen. Perhaps you remember that charming childhood story about the little red hen who tries to bake some bread by starting with planting wheat, but can't enlist her barnyard friends in the effort. To jog your memory, here's how it goes. Once upon a time, there was a little red hen who lived on a farm. She was friends with a lazy dog, a sleepy cat, and a noisy yellow duck. One day, she found some seeds on the ground and had an idea. She'd plant the seeds, so she asked her friends for help. "Not I," barked the lazy dog. "Not I," purred the sleepy cat. "Not I," quacked the yellow duck. "Then I will," said the little red hen. In the kitchen classrooms of the edible schoolyards, this story is used to help the littlest students learn the concept of teamwork. As they recite the story, they make an easy soda bread and are rewarded for their efforts with a slice of lovely hot bread they baked themselves. For a copy of the Edible Schoolyard soda bread recipe or learn more about the Edible Schoolyard program, visit our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com and wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. How long will food stay edible in your refrigerator and freezer if the power goes out? Stay tuned, and when we come right back, we'll give you the skinny on food safety in a storm. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How long will food stay edible in your refrigerator and freezer if the power goes out? According to the U.S. government's Food Safety Guide, only 4 hours. The magic number for temperature is 40 degrees. Once the fridge hits over that 40-degree mark for 2 hours, the meat, poultry, fish, eggs, and leftovers are all headed for the garbage. That includes things you might think are fairly stable, like pizza, luncheon meats, hot dogs, and even soft cheeses like Monterey Jack and mozzarella. The hard cheeses like cheddar will be safe to eat for a while, along with fresh fruit and veggies. For goodness sake, don't taste anything to see if it's still good. When in doubt, throw it out. Now about that freezer. A full freezer will be fine for 48 hours, but if your freezer's only half full, that time is reduced by half. Once the power is restored, each item in your freezer will need to be evaluated separately. If anything feels cold, as if it were refrigerated, or still has ice crystals, it's safe to refreeze. I hope we never see an entire city of refrigerators filled with rotting food out on the curb again. So, be smart, be safe, and carry on. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Recently, the Louisiana Eats crew hit the road to get to know some new restaurants in the Bywater neighborhood.
What do we want?
we began our tour at Pizza Delicious, a popular spot a block away from the Mississippi River, where a variety of different diners were seated chowing down on garlic knots and slices of thin crust pizza.
I mean, I'll eat that.
So, we would like to have a margarita.
Okay.
And a Amphi pale ale. We ordered my favorite, a 16-inch margarita, and sat down with co-owner Michael Friedman to discuss his journey from pop-up to popular restaurateur.
So I'm Michael Friedman, and with my partner Greg Algarden, we are the two owners of Pizza Delicious down in the Bywater.
You have been one of the leaders in the forefront of the amazing Bywater situation. So tell me why you are here and why you're here doing what you're doing in this specific place.
I came to New Orleans 11 years ago to go to Tulane University. Freshman move-in day for my residence, I trained to be an RA. My sophomore year was also evacuation day for Hurricane Katrina. That was an interesting twist to my New Orleans experience. I was here a year before the storm and came back, was anxious to get back, finished up school, thought I might head back to New York and was trying...
What were you studying? You weren't studying pizza.
Tulane didn't have a pizza program yet. And so... I was doing education, and I studied to be a high school English teacher, which I was. I taught at Chalmette High School for a bit. Go Owls. And also, I'd always been interested in cooking, and so I had started to cook at Boucherie, and I just loved it. And Greg was my roommate towards the end of college, and we just kind of always lamented the state of pizza in New Orleans, both being native New Yorkers. And we had this idea. We're like, hey, if we start making pizza... and it's good, people might show up. And we had no idea how many people would. We started this pop-up, 5.5 years ago or something, right down in the Bywater, a few blocks from where we are now. And it was amazing. We were just doing Sunday nights. We had a pay-as-you-go cell phone, and we only did to-go advance orders of pizza. And within a couple months, it just exploded. We ended up doing that for 2.5 years. People just kind of encouraging us to open up a brick and mortar. We started looking, and did not want to leave the neighborhood because the neighborhood had just been so supportive. There's so many people living here who are just dying for different types of food. So we looked and found this warehouse in the Bywater and just kind of went for it. We didn't know much about what we were doing, but we knew our pizza was pretty good at that point, and that's what kind of carried us through.
I would love for you to take us back a little bit and tell us how you see the evolution of this area that you're so firmly entrenched in now.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting. I mean, when we started the pop-up, we were really kind of down an alleyway on a residential street, knowing the Bywater had this rich past of restaurants and more bars and stores that just kind of faded away over time. And so there just wasn't as much going on in the neighborhood in terms of options and places to eat. And we just kind of watched over time as we were developing that pop-up and had the idea to go full-time. Other restaurants just started getting in the mix. Satsuma Cafe was each year, it seemed like, just busier and busier line out the door. Morapa Foods was probably the first kind of, I guess, sit down. And so they had made this big commitment, did this big build out right on the corner of Burgundy. And so we were kind of, I guess we followed them by the time we had finished up building our spot here on Piety, and just knew of so many more places in the neighborhood that were about to open up, And so it was a really exciting time just being we're just here on the street and there's not that many other places around here. And within a year of us opening, it was just kind of boom, boom, boom. Places just started opening up.
You know, a lot of cynical people will say to me, over 1,000 new restaurants in New Orleans since Hurricane Katrina? Well, when's the attrition coming? Surely that many restaurants can't be supported. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think we have always wondered, it's just continued to get busier and busier when we've opened, and we're always okay, when's this gonna taper off? surely everyone's come to the Bywater already. Like, they've had their experience. Like, it's nice. And it just seems like more and more and more people just keep coming to the area. People have heard of us, heard of this neighborhood, never really ventured out here. And the most surprising part to me has just been tourism in the past couple years has just been, I mean, we get tourists, like, in here coming, walking from the quarter who read that, like, this is a cool neighborhood. Like, you really can't experience New Orleans without a trip to the Bywater, which is super cool. I mean, it's really cool for us. We had, you know, a table of Brits in here the other day, and I'm like, how did you find out about this place? You know, like, how did, and they're like, we heard it was really great. You know, someone told us it was awesome. We walked in the 95 degree weather from the quarter to get to your restaurant.
And eat some pizza.
Yeah, it's like, I love that. You know, it's so cool.
What is your favorite time of day down here? What's your favorite part of being right here at Crescent Park at Pizza Delicious?
I love a couple of things. I would say the weekends are really, really cool. Just during the day when people finally wake up from their hangovers and are finally getting out and are just, it's become such a great area to walk around in. There's a lot of families in this neighborhood now, which is very, very cool. And so it's just like peeking my head out into the street and just seeing how many people are just walking around. There's little art markets that set up. And so I love weekend days. And also at night when it just kind of gets, when there are like plays going on, there's a lot of reasons for people to be in the area. And it's just kind of like bustling around the neighborhood. And I'm like, this was not happening a few years ago. It's really, really cool. It's exciting for us. I mean, getting a huge like late night drunk rush of people is so gratifying. We feel happy to provide that service.
Describe what makes your pizza so delicious. And, you know, I think I have to have a piece of pizza.
I was going to say, don't let your pizza get too cold.
It's killing me. What's the experience like when you come here as a customer, and what makes your pizza so good?
Well, we make New York-style pizza, which was something that we were having a hard time finding down here. I'm watching you eat it right now. You're doing the right thing, folding the crust. We have big 18-inch, sometimes even 20-inch pies, depending on how we make them. And the reason they vary is because we hand-toss every single one of them, make all our dough here, make all of our sauce here, make as many toppings here as we can. And so we just get really, really into making a really good slice of pizza because it's what we grew up eating. And coming down here, it's kind of, it gets a little crazy. We don't have that big of a place. So if you come at like a peak time, it's kind of like counter service. You seat yourself. It's in an old warehouse spot. So it's just kind of, music's usually a little louder. Bounces, a lot of sound bouncing off the walls. But it's just kind of fun. And the nights go from early on, we get a bunch of families in here. There's kids running around the dining room to kind of a like rowdier, like pitchers of beer, late night crowd. People just chowing on some pizza, garlic knots, pastas.
Is Pizza Delicious a standalone experience in the Bywater, or might we see it someplace else one day?
It's a very good question. We get it a lot, which is flattering. As of right now, we just want to keep this one place going. We love it so much, and we want the food to be always great and always on point and want it to be consistent. And it's tough, you know, with the volume that we end up doing. And so we'll see. We'll see. We have an open mind, but we just kind of want to enjoy what we're doing right now and really, really love being where in this neighborhood and keeping it going.
Bravo, Mike Friedman, for turning the pizza world of New Orleans around. And thank you so much for having us at Pizza Delicious today.
Thank you so much for coming down here. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Michael Friedman of Pizza Delicious.
When Tobias Womack and Amy Mossberger moved to New Orleans 2 years ago, they had one simple goal in mind: to open up a restaurant that filled some existing gap in the culinary scene. Having been trained at the wildly popular Mission Chinese on the Lower East Side of New York, an idea sparked when they noticed what they considered to be a lack of Chinese cuisine in the Crescent City. Like so many others in the past 10 years, Tobias and Amy settled along St. Claude Avenue in the Bywater and started a pop-up delivery service that eventually evolved into the brick-and-mortar restaurant, now known as Red's Chinese.
Me and Amy, we came down after having met in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, and we came down to New Orleans to relocate and to open a restaurant. And we looked around at what was missing. That's really where it started. And we asked ourselves, where are we needed? And what are our talents? And Amy and myself have a similar palate. We both like very spicy, sour, sweet, bitter, funky, fermented foods. And we were eating a lot of Vietnamese cuisine. We were at Dong Phong and Pho Tao Bay and all these wonderful local Vietnamese restaurants. And then we'd go and we'd mix it up and we'd go and have Chinese food. And there's a lot of wonderful Chinese restaurants, but not what we were looking for. We wanted that Korean, that Japanese. We wanted the exotic, and we knew how we could. We knew that we could do that. We could take the Asian cuisine and make it a little bit more authentic and a little weirder.
Tobias, why did you and Amy decide to come to New Orleans?
Love. Love that the city shares and has shared historically with food, with tradition, with culture, with music, with cuisine. And I told myself that I would one day visit New Orleans. I would make it a point to find that place. And I found it. Here it is.
So when did you first move down here?
2 years ago.
Yeah. So you all are really, out of everybody that we're talking to in this Bywater scene, y'all are the newcomers. You're the newest newcomers.
That's been a struggle, you know. I think we knew that coming into it, too, that, you know, New Orleans is very open and receptive to people that are willing to embrace the city. I've never felt like people were like, oh, you're from New York, you know, you're a carpetbagger, or, you know, you're a bad person, you're a gentrifier. Nobody's ever said those words to me on both sides of the street.
Why did you decide to open in the Bywater? Why was this your spot?
A total happenstance. We found an apartment on Clouette Street, and we started branching out from the apartment and looking for places to rent and to work, to build a business. So we went down St. Claude, and we passed this building late one night, and there was like some rough remnants of like an old commercial history to it. You know, it kind of felt like it might have been a convenience store at one time, or it might have been a restaurant. And we kind of like peeked through this little hole in the window, and we saw that there was a kitchen. And then we started a dialogue with the people upstairs, and sure enough, they gave me the landlord's number, and the landlord turned out to be totally open to what we wanted to do, and we were blown away that they would even consider our zany idea of opening a Chinese restaurant. And they're like, yeah, right, come on. You guys, you're going to do Chinese food?
So you came here 2.5 years ago, but you start off in the delivery business. So what was that about, Tobias?
The delivery business was done out of our laundry room.
Your laundry room?
Our laundry room, yeah. We literally got 3 propane tanks and some camp stoves and a big fan and set it up in our laundry room. We didn't have the funds and we didn't have the space to begin with to open a proper restaurant, but we wanted to be independent and we wanted to give back to the community and start something. We knew that we could do that here. So we just said, all right, let's do it. We made the flyers and just, we papered the whole neighborhood. And it was a Tuesday, it was 2 years ago, and me and Amy were sitting in the kitchen, staring at the phone, and we're like, is it going to ring? And we're like looking at each other, and we're like, and then the phone rang. We couldn't believe it. We're like, hello. And somebody else was on the end of the line. They're like, hi, can I get some Chinese food? We're like, yeah. What would you like?
That's a really great beginning to a food business. That's awesome. Now that you've actually got a front door that people walk through, what's the reaction now?
The reaction is good. I think people had really high expectations because of Mission Chinese from me and Amy. What's been really great is that we get older couples and we get families that come into the restaurant. That's like, you know, and we get a lot of Vietnamese people that come in too. And that's like, that's awesome for me. That's really cool. It's not just young people with their cool haircuts and their rad shirts. I wish I had more energy and we could stay open later on Monday nights so that we could accommodate all the chefs and all the restaurateurs and all the servers and bussers and bartenders and really like make their life way more hospitable on their day off. It's big portions, it's affordable, it's a relaxed environment, and that's key for us, you know. And nobody else is really open on Mondays too. That's another thing, is like everyone's closed in this neighborhood. So we stayed open to accommodate for the restaurant industry and for all the staff, you know. There's no great like Red's Chinese mission statement, you know. At the end of the day, we're just trying to make really good food and make it in a comfortable environment. That's it.
Tobias Womack, chef and co-owner at Red's Chinese. Chef Michael Doyle has always had a tremendous affinity for seasonal local food. When he opened Maurepas Food in the Bywater, his restaurant stood out in the crowd for just that. On the last stop of our tour, we sat down with Michael to hear his point of view on the Bywater scene. You are really one of the very earliest who opened down here. So tell me about when you opened and why you chose this neighborhood.
Sure. I opened in January of 2012 after many delays and budget overruns and all the things that go along with opening a restaurant. I was looking at Bywater with Marini. I felt like they were underserved. I hang out down here a lot. Bacchanal is great. Elizabeth, Satsuma. I had recently bought a house down here that we were renovating. So I felt like this is a great neighborhood to do a neighborhood style restaurant with maybe just slightly more innovative food. But that same idea of the kind of place you go to anytime, it's friendly, your kids are welcome, your grandparents are welcome, everyone can come, and from there it just sort of took off.
Tell me about your food concept.
We work with, depending on the season, anywhere from about 15 to 30 local farmers and fishermen. Bring in whatever they have, and we really try to let them take the lead. I've never really been the type who can sort of sit and have inspiration come to me. I sort of need that big pile of vegetables and get all the fishes in, and that's really where it comes from. It's just from processing that, doing the work, and we sort of come up with dishes from there. And we see this as Creole food, and maybe not Creole with a capital C, but repeating that exact same process of really working with the local farms, the local waters, and taking all the people who are moving here and moving out and the influences and what we eat and where everyone comes from as they sort of land here, sort of a transient culture, and putting that all together and hopefully coming up with some sort of cuisine out of it.
Well, it is a transient culture because I really think that what's going on down here in the Bywater, well, my goodness, before Hurricane Katrina, not very many people would have considered this as the next place to live. And yet it's incredibly booming. It's the hot spot now. Tell me about your customers. Who are your customers and what surprises you about them?
Our customers are, I would say probably about 50, 60% of our guests are coming from the surrounding neighborhood. So Marini, Bywater, we have a lot of French Quarter residents who dine here. We tend to skew probably a little bit younger. Our price point is lower. The food portions are a little smaller. The wines are a little more offbeat. So we skew a little younger. A lot of women. I don't know why that is. I never considered myself to have food that would draw. I didn't know that all I had to do was all of a sudden I could attract women my own age. If I had known this at age 18,
You would have had a restaurant a long time ago, huh?
I suppose so, and destroyed it.
Michael, tell me about the name of the restaurant. Why did you call it Maurepas, and what does that mean?
Maurepas is the second largest lake in Louisiana. Lake Maurepas is directly west of Lake Pontchartrain. And I suppose it's got significance for any number of reasons. I really looked at it as sort of naming the building. If you see the building, it's got one of those corner doors that sticks out and a big steel awning. And various this sort of corner grocery look to the outside of it. So I wanted a sort of name that was vaguely grocery-like, and I wanted that sort of vaguely geographical name. We get a large amount of our vegetables right out of the Maurepas Basin, right between the Mississippi River and Lake Maurepas in St. James Parish. We work with a farmer very closely out there, Tony Accardo, who is excellent and grows just the sort of oddball stuff that I like to use. And so that was sort of the one. That, and on top of that, it's hard to spell, it's hard to pronounce, the place is hard to find. It's got everything you need for success is in this building. It also is French slang for bad meal. So
no, it is not.
I had a French guest early on point that out to me, and I love it. I couldn't ask for a better name that way.
That is hilarious. I love that. You have such a great spot here. You're really in the heart of the Bywater in this area. And you've got these great big windows. What do you see going by outside?
Stay here long enough, you'll see the whole world go by. Mardi Gras, it's hard to beat. We don't actually open on Fat Tuesday. We just throw a party here. Because we've got the St. Anne Parade starts all right in here. You've got everybody marching out. But that whole season around then, you've got people with their giant bicycle contraptions that they build, and people running down with the huge masks, and the skull and bones come through here. That's probably one of my favorites that I see, is every year you sort of know the season's coming when you start to see that around. I have seen cars run into buildings. We've seen a giant pallet of fireworks a couple weeks ago, like a big one, like a 6x6, went sky high of mortars right out there. We see it all right here.
This neighborhood is on a continual change. It's growing. It's exploding. What do you think is going to happen next and in the future of the Bywater?
Oh, I don't know. That's that is a loaded question, and I'm not sure I have all the answers. I guess I'm of two minds. I'm a resident, and I'm a business owner. And honestly, as a resident, I love having all the restaurants, but I want a bank and I want a grocery store. And that's not going to happen unless we get some more density in this neighborhood. These two neighborhoods, you're talking, what, 1,700 households, maybe 3,500 people. So unless you're pulling destination dining, it's a struggle to sort of continually do the restaurant business. So I don't know what's going to come next. Either we're going to have high rises on the river, which would bring the people that we need to sort of sustain this. And then all of a sudden, maybe a grocery store chain looks at us and says, all right, maybe there's enough people now with enough income to go in there. Or we don't do it. And then, well, we'll see some attrition. And that's just the way it's going to be. This is not sustainable how it is. Something's got to give, but I've never heard of a bedroom community with a middle to high-end restaurant on every single block, and that's essentially what we're running right now. So time will tell, but one way or the other, this is either going to sort of shrink back into sleepier neighborhood territory, or it's going to urbanize real fast. I'm not the one who makes those decisions. Kind of watching it all play out and decide when to take that second mortgage.
Chef Michael Doyle of Maurepas Foods. When we come back from a short break, Gambit editor Kevin Allman will join us with the inside scoop on a hot new hip Bywater restaurant that's so underground, it's a good bet you've never heard of it. You don't want to miss this. so don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. If you're looking to visit the hottest restaurants in New Orleans, you'd be wise to talk to Kevin Allman, editor of Gambit Magazine. We recently spoke with Kevin about one of the newest, trendiest restaurants in the Bywater that you've probably never heard of. Kevin, I am so happy that I was able to get you to sit down with us and share some really amazing restaurant scoop that you've got for us. Something new in the New Orleans Bywater scene.
In the Bywater, yeah.
And God knows the Bywater scene. Everything down there is like growing by leaps and bounds. I can hardly keep up. Can you?
No, because if you haven't been down there for a week, there's going to be something different, whether it's going to be a new restaurant, a new chef, a new menu, something like that going on. And with the influx of all the new people that have come here since the storm, that seems to be a place that a lot of them have settled. Some of them are really riffing on our tradition. Some of them have brought in their own traditions. But I think most of them are trying to combine the two. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's always interesting.
Well, you guys at Gambit always have the scoop. So what's new, Kevin?
Well, we just ran a review of a new restaurant. It's called No. It's pronounced No, but it's actually spelled, and this is all lowercase, N:EAUX. So it's like O, water, but it's No. And the first No that comes at No is that you can't make a reservation there.
Oh, I hate that.
Well, no, this is different than that. It's not, you don't wait in line. If you want to eat there, they make the reservation with you. You go online and you fill out this web form and it asks you a few questions and you put in your credit card number and links to your Twitter and your Tumblr and your social media accounts and they look it over. I don't know what criteria they use to decide how cool you are, but if they like it, then they'll text you back the time and the date that they will seat you. And then from there, you have to actually download a smartphone app, and they have it for iPhone or Android, and that app is going to be an integral part of your dining experience while you're at No.
Wow. You have to really, really, really want to eat there, I suppose, to put up with all this, but I'm game. I'm always game for what's new. So you get lucky enough to make the cut, and they tell you when to be there and where to go.
Right. Right. And you download the app, which has your menu on it, and you go in, and you don't go to the dining room first, even if you've got a reservation. You go into the bar, and the bar is pitch black.
I've been in some dark bars.
No, this is like blackout curtains. This is like World War II blackout.
Okay.
And you are not allowed to speak because they want everyone to really experience the drinks themselves. So you can't see the drinks. You're not talking to the people that you're with. These things are just put in your hand, and they've got a pretty amazing drinks program. They have something called a Ramazarak French 75, which is a hybrid. It's got whiskey, gin, champagne, Morgan City Farms lemon juice, and the white of an egg from a Marigny free-range chicken. There's also something called an English turnip for what, and that's kind of a dealer's choice thing. All they'll tell you is that every week that it's going to be Mississippi River forward, and I'm not quite sure what that means as far as tasting goes.
Is it brown?
I don't know, because it's dark in there. You can't see what you're drinking. But the drinks, they're in these big, giant kind of igloo coolers, and they pour them into red Solo cups with poetry written on the side, which you can read when you go into the dining room. And this is new. They actually have an artisanal ice menu at this place. So, and that's part of what you download on your app. So you can select the kind of ice cubes you want, if you want smoked ice or if you want chipped ice and all this. And the ice cubes range from $1 to $5 a piece.
You pay extra for ice cubes?
Well, it's an ingredient in the drink, as they've told me.
Okay.
And you pay for the ingredients that you're eating. You know, it's not like, it's not just like some piece of ice that you get out of a
you're
machine.
Right.
These are
you're
special.
Right.
So
I'm sorry.
And then you're taking it into the restaurant itself. Which is this long, 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 like football field size long table with just one person on each side. So it is communal dining, basically, but for hundreds, hundreds of people. And you're not allowed to sit with the people that you came with because they want to encourage, as they say, community. People from Brooklyn and Portland are really big on community and all of that. Also, to build community, they don't have enough utensils for everyone. And
what?
That's by design.
Okay.
And there aren't traditional servers either. So as I said, they decide what you're going to eat. And when your meal is ready, your app buzzes in your pocket like you might get the buzzer at Zia's or something like that when the food's ready. And you walk into the kitchen and they call it foraging. There's a bunch of food out there and you have to find what you've ordered. And it's just like, you know, foraging, which is a term that we've all come to know since the storm.
This takes it to a new level.
If you happen to be picking up an order or you see someone picking up an order that looks good, in order to build more community, you're even, you offer to exchange bites of your food and all of this stuff. So they really want to get people talking in the kitchen. And I think it cuts down on labor costs too.
So what's the food like, this precious food?
The food, it varies from time to time. I've only been lucky enough to get in there once. So, I mean, you might talk to Ian McNulty or Brett Anderson because I think they've been there a lot more often than I have.
Okay.
But they don't divide it into entrees and mains and things like that. They have things they call excitements, amusements, and distractions.
Distractions?
Yeah, and I'm not sure what the difference between any of them are, frankly. But
were you distracted?
I was definitely distracted. The night I went, I had... you know what tofurkey is, right?
Of
it's like
course.
Turkey, but it's made out of tofu.
Yes.
And pork belly is really hot. So they had a tofurkey belly sandwich. And it was finished in a reduction of pineapple Big Shot and Pabst Blue Ribbon. And they served it like a banh mi, which is very popular these days, as we all know.
Of course.
And then the sandwich itself was crusted with Roman candy from the Roman Candy Man and Zapp's chips. So it was very local.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. They also had what they call the deconstructed shrimp po' boy, which is kind of like spa cuisine. And it was a single breaded shrimp on this huge, huge square plate with a smear of Creole tomato jam and what they called Bogalusa Farms iceberg lettuce foam. So I guess you dip the shrimp in the tomato jam and then the iceberg lettuce foam.
Okay.
And, of course, kale, you know, is huge, huge, huge these days. And I did not try this because I don't care for kale.
Uh-huh.
And I don't care for people who care for kale. But their most popular dish, and I think it's on the menu just about every night, is called the Flight of Six Kales. And it's kale prepared five different ways, but it's served on an edible plank actually made out of kale.
I'd like to see that.
It's a very smooth experience at the end, too. I mean, we're all used to Uber now and things like that where you just get out of the car and you don't have to pay anyone. You don't have to pay when you leave here because you've already arranged that when you get there. So when you're finished, you just walk out and catch your Uber or whatever you're going to do. And the app that you downloaded on your phone automatically deducts the cost of your meal. And if you have Bitcoin, it takes it out of your Bitcoin account.
Okay.
It adds a 35% tip, which I guess is standard for them. And
wow.
It sends all the images of everything you've eaten to your Instagram and Snapchat accounts. And then it leaves the restaurant a 5-star Yelp review, so you don't even have to worry about doing that.
Well, that's a little nervy.
Well, that's you know, I guess
the future, huh?
That's the future. That's the future. So, yeah, that's no. And
okay. Well, I'm going to get back with you about this, Kevin.
Well,
if they'll let me in.
Well, they don't have a listed phone number and they don't have a listed address. That's the tough part. So you've just got to go online and maybe Google it or maybe go to Yelp and see if you can find someone who's been lucky enough to get in there and experience all this.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Poppy, for having us.
That's Kevin Allman of Gambit Magazine. Okay, full disclosure. That interview was, if you haven't already guessed, a satire. The restaurant, no, exists only in Kevin's imagination. But who knows? Maybe the trend of drinking quietly in a pitch dark room will catch on. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we visit the undisputed king of crawfish, Al Scramuza.
I said, you fish crawfish? He said, oh, yeah. I said, how much you pay y'all? 2 cents a pound. I said, well, you go ahead and buy them for them for 2 cents a pound, and I'll give you 3 cents a pound.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine,
with a view of Jackson Square. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.